Hello and welcome. This is D. Garrett Nadeau presenting one of a number of podcasts on behalf of the Lancashire Authors Association. Today's guest is Melinda Hammond, who also writes as Sarah Mallory. Welcome, Melinda.
Welcome. Hi.
Glad to have you here. Can you tell us a little bit, first of all, about yourself and about your association with Lancashire Authors?
Well, I'm actually a West Country girl who moved north about 25 years ago. I live now on the Lancashire-Yorkshire border, just about 8 miles from Bronte country. So I'm hoping that the inspiration from the Brontes is rubbing off on me. And I was approached by Lancashire Authors, and I'm now very proudly one of their patrons.
How long have you been a patron? Is it
About a year.
About a year or so,
year,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And how many books have you written? Do you know how many?
It must be 25 or more published.
Right.
Written more than that. I think most writers have a few in the drawer as well.
Yeah. But equally as Melinda Hammond and Sarah Mallory?
I started as Melinda Hammond, and I've got about a dozen or so published. And then when I started writing for Harlequin, Mills and Boone, I chose a different name, Sarah Mallory, just to have a slightly different brand, because Melinda Hammond is, I write my my Regency historicals, historical romances, but also I have a few other slightly different books, time slip, dual time novels that I've written.
How did you get started writing? What inspired you to?
I've always written, ever since I could put pen to paper. I started telling stories to children at school. School friends, and always wanted to write. And when I gave up work to have my first child, I thought that was a great time to actually get one of these stories finished and into book form. And I was very fortunate that I got it published. That was about in 1980.
Wow, that's great. Yeah. So I understand, you know, what you're saying is very much like Jane Austen, because Jane Austen, I understand, is one of your favourite authors, and she started writing when she was just a little girl,
she
too,
was
a
huge influence. It was something I discovered, partly through a very early BBC serial. They used to do tea time dramas on the BBC back in the days of black and white, long, long time ago, and they did a Pride and Prejudice series, which I loved. I then bought the book. I must have been 12, 13, and the very next term at school, it was one of the set texts.
Right.
So all of a sudden, I was thrown headlong into Jane Austen. And from that, I read all of them, and I reread them regularly now.
If I recall correctly, there was a Laurence Olivier version of Pride and Prejudice.
Thankfully, that was a bit before my time.
Oh, that, yes. But I just wondered if you'd seen that one.
It's actually, despite being very Hollywood Jane Austen,
it is. Yeah.
It is actually quite fun.
Yeah,
I must say, I do enjoy that one. My favourite, though, I have to say, is the Colin Firth.
Right.
Okay. One, the Andrew Davies version, which was the BBC one in 1995.
Right. I believe you brought some music in for that.
Yes. And one of the pieces I've chosen is Carl Davis's music, the overture from Pride and Prejudice.
Perhaps we can listen to a little bit of that. The Carl Davis music from Pride and Prejudice, the BBC series.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Carl Davis, music from Pride and Prejudice, the BBC series. We were talking a little bit about Jane Austen, Melinda. Have you got a favourite Jane Austen, a book that's your favourite one? Or you...
I think now my favourite is Persuasion.
Really?
When Persuasion. I was younger, it was Pride and Prejudice.
I love think, Pride and Prejudice, yeah.
That's quintessential romance. Persuasion tends, in my mind, it's more... the character development of Anne and the captain.
I've got Northanger Abbey and Persuasion here with me. What is it about Jane Austen that everybody seems to love? What's her formula for success?
I think it's because people can recognize the characters. They could be friends or relatives. Recognize character traits there. She's very good at that. And in the last couple of hundred years, human nature hasn't really changed that much.
Right.
I think as you go further back, maybe the character traits are a little different because society was so different. But certainly by the time Jane Austen was writing, we would recognize the people that she writes about. They could be living in the same street.
Yeah, for me, it's the depth. I mean, I've just brought with me Northanger Abbey, and this is just at the very beginning of it. The heroine is called Catherine Morland, and this is part of the description, if you don't mind me reading that, because I'd like to talk about this little bit that I'm going to read. Mm-hmm. This is Catherine Morland is being described by Jane Austen. Writing in accounts, she was taught by her father. French by her mother. Her proficiency in either was not remarkable, and she shirked her lessons in both whenever she could. What a strange, unaccountable character, for with all these symptoms of profligacy, at 10 years old, she had neither a bad heart nor a bad temper, was seldom stubborn, scarcely ever quarrelsome, and very kind to the little ones, with few interruptions of tyranny. She was, moreover, noisy and wild, hated confinement and cleanliness, and loved nothing so well in the world as rolling down the green slope at the back of the house. Such was Catherine Morland at 10. At 15, appearances were mending. She began to curl her hair and long for balls. Her complexion improved. Her features were softened by plumpness and color. Her eyes gained more animation, and her figure more consequence. Her love of dirt gave way to an inclination for finery, and she grew clean as she grew smart. She had now the pleasure of sometimes hearing her father and mother remark on her personal improvement. Catherine grows quite a good-looking girl. She is almost pretty today, were words which caught her ears now and then. And how welcome were those sounds. To look almost pretty is an acquisition of higher delight to a girl who has been looking plain the first 15 years of her life than a beauty from her cradle can ever receive. I think what I like about Jane Austen is the depth. I mean, there's just so much there to the description. I mean, so many aspects to her personality and the humor.
True, but you could also apply that to almost any teenager or a lot of teenagers today. It's still relevant.
Do you think that's too much?
Not for me personally, because I love Jane Austen, but maybe for some modern readers it might be a little long. It's very difficult for a writer because you're so in tune with your characters and you get to love them like children.
Yeah, yeah.
And one knows that when one is talking about children, it can be so easy to go on and bore your audience rigid. So being a writer with your characters is a bit like being a parent of children. You love them more than other people, but you have to cut back a bit or else you'll bore people.
Yeah, yeah. How do you start? Do you start with physical description or does it depend on the character? Do you start with conversations about the character or?
For me, the actual character always starts with a very vague visual in my head and, also, tends to be characteristics more than an actual physical appearance. When I'm actually writing, I like to find pictures of actors, models, or people that I can put on a storyboard and refer to when I'm actually writing the description in the book. But that's very minor, really, compared to the actual character that comes through.
How do your characters come to you? Are they composites of people that you tend to know, or is it somebody that just suddenly appears like a ghost on your shoulder? And
they tend to be more like the ghost on the shoulder, really, or a visual in the head. It's just someone who is there. They tend to grow on you.
And you're not quite sure where they come from.
Not too sure where they come from. They tend to become more familiar as the book goes on.
Do you write like first thing in the morning, or?
I tend to write office hours. I'd like to be at my desk and working by 9, and I try and go on till 4 or 5.
Wow, that's so you spend all day. If I can.
It's very difficult when you're looking at the time you actually spend writing. By the time you've got up, made a cup of tea, just looked at the garden, taken a phone call, checked the news, checked your phones, checked the internet. Very difficult to do a 4 days writing. If you do 4 hours for writing in a day, that is quite good. I've used a timer to prove it. So.
Right, okay. Do you try to write a certain number of words every day? Do you sort of set a goal of 2,000 words?
Not
or?
Really, because of researching at the same time. That doesn't always work. But I tend to have a once a month. By the end of a month, I need to be at a certain stage in the book. So many thousand words through. And I write about, for my Mills and Boone historicals, I write about one book every 4 months. So.
One book every 4 months.
I need to keep up the
pace. And do you have a target sort of number of words? Because Mills and Boons, I think you're restricted to.
They're about 75 for historicals. They're a bit longer than their contemporaries, and it's around 75,000 to 80,000.
Right.
So it's quite a.
And they don't like it if you write any more than that.
To do with the constraints of the publishing, because they are still print. Based. Maybe if everything goes to digital one day, that might change. But
yeah, because it costs more to publish a book.
Of course, they have a word length. They can only make the print so small, certain size. If it gets too small and you can't read it, they won't publish it. So it's restricted.
Okay. Well, perhaps time for a little bit more music. I think you brought along Rachmaninoff.
Yes, it's a bit of an old war horse, Rachmaninoff's second piano concerto, the music that was used in the film Brief Encounter, which has always been a favourite of mine since I first saw it years ago. It's very romantic. The music is very romantic. A typical British film.
Okay, let's listen to a bit of that. Right, that was Rachmaninoff, Piano Concerto, second movement, used in Brief Encounter. I think Melinda and I were agreeing just now, one of the great British films, Brief Encounter, was. Is romance and the romantic side of your writing is...
Romantic adventure is what I really like. I grew up with The Count of Monte Cristo and Scaramouche. Right. The books of Geoffrey Farnell, who isn't so well known these days, but he was a contemporary of Georgette Heyer. His books are, I think they tend to be more Georgian and maybe even 17th century historical romances rather than the Regency in Georgian. But it's the romance with an adventurous streak.
So those are the kinds of books that you grew up reading.
That's what I grew up reading and I've always wanted to write. Basically what happened was I loved Georgette Heyer's books. And she died in 1974. And at that stage, I realized that if I wanted to read something like hers, I was going to have to write my own. And I started doing that. I'd always been writing, scribbling things, various odd little stories, but never a purposeful novel. Right.
So would you say that when you started writing, your audience basically was yourself? You were writing for yourself, do you think?
Yes. Firm believer in that you have to write for yourself first. You have to write from the heart. You have to write. I'm not sure you need to write what you know about, but you have to write what you love.
What you want to read.
What you would like to read
yourself.
Yes.
I would agree with that. I think that's how I approach it too. The books that you've written, have they changed, do you think, over time? Are they similar?
They're similar. I'm hoping I've improved as a writer. One always wants to improve. It's no good to stand still. I think my earlier books are probably a little bit simpler. They're always fairly simple plots because they're light-hearted comedy romances or romantic adventures. I think they're probably a little deeper now, a little more mature.
How do you approach your writing? Do you write a first draft fairly quickly and then go through the editing process, or do you think you edit as you go along?
I tend to edit as I go along. If I get stuck, then I go back and edit the earlier chapters until I'm ready to move on. It depends. Sometimes I start with the end of a book. The end of a book will be there first.
Right.
I'll have the last few chapters in my head and I'll write that bit out. And then I'll go back and write the rest of the story to tie it in with it. Other times I start with just, as simple as a line. I have a book going up on Kindle soon, one of my early Georgian romances called A Lady at Midnight, and that started with the title. I always wanted to write a book called A Lady at Midnight, so I wrote the whole thing, the whole romance spread out from that.
Sometimes it works like that. Mm. Do you plot the book out fairly carefully?
No.
Or do you like no. not to know what's going to happen?
Don't they call it, you're either a plotter or a pantser, writing by the seat of your pants, and that's me. If I plot it too much, I lose interest because the book's written then, as far as I'm concerned. I know what's going to happen at the end because I always like happy ever after endings. But apart from that, how they get there, what they're going to do in the middle, no idea.
Yeah. I have this theory that writing is about self-discovery, maybe this is just for me, but it's that surprise aspect, that thing you're not expecting to happen, that you don't quite know what your characters are going to do. Mm-hmm. You know it's a subconscious part of yourself that's coming through, but you're kind of discovering yourself as you go along. Do you think
that's
the way it works?
I think that's true. I can be writing sometimes, and it's almost like being in a trance. You suddenly wake up. Have no idea what you've written, but it's the story.
Yeah.
And the characters will sometimes take over and go off the way they want to.
Yeah. There's a writer called Dorothea Brand who wrote a book on how to write. It's different from other how to write books in that it's about motivation and about structuring your writing. And she says that, and this was written in the 1920s, she says that what a writer should do is first thing in the morning, before they even make a cup of tea or even get dressed or anything, just sit down and start writing. Because whatever's happened in your brain in the night can then come out. It gives it free flow and it allows that subconscious mm-hmm. to come through. I'm not sure that would work for me. I like to have a cup of coffee or
I need to wake up a bit first. Sometimes I can wake up and there's an idea there. I do keep a notepad by the bed.
Right.
But it tends to be just a line or a small sentence that will then jog the memory to take something forward.
Are you able to, when you say you finish at about 4 or 5, mm-hmm. Are you then able to kind of in your head, put it away, you have to have a pen and a piece of paper close by to kind of anything down.
I sometimes have to jot something down if I think I might forget it, but usually it's just everything is mulling over, ready to start again. Next time I sit down at the computer, it's almost like freeze frame on a DVD or a video. It stops. And then I go back and can start again.
Right.
Maybe that's something I've learned over the years.
Okay. Well, we'll talk more about that in a minute. Maybe time for a little bit more music. I think you brought in some Tchaikovsky.
Yes. This is the 1812 Overture. I just finished writing a book based around Waterloo. This is due to come out next year to coincide with the bicentenary of the battle. And when I was writing it, I like to listen to music while I'm writing. It drives out all other sounds and stops distractions for me. And I wanted something stirring and rousing. And 1812 is about as close as I could get. It was written for one of the Napoleonic Wars, but it was Russia versus France, obviously. But I just thought it fits pretty well with writing about a battle. So that's why I chose it, and it's a favorite.
Okay, let's listen to a little bit of Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture.
Thank you.
right, that was Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Melinda, we were just talking a little bit about that particular period of time and those very significant events going on in the world. What drew you to that in particular? Anything?
I think it's the background to the Napoleonic Wars. I grew up, I was a bit of a tomboy growing up. So it was all war games or cowboys and Indians. So I do like fighting and battles and things.
Do you see Napoleon as a kind of a romantic figure?
Not really. I think he tends to feature more as an arch-villain versus Wellington. But we have done a couple of battlefield tours, and I find I like the battles. I don't like to go into too much detail. I wouldn't appeal to those who like technical detail on the size of the guns and the caliber of the rifles or muskets or whatever. But I do like the battle scenes. I like Sharp, Bernard Cornwell's books, and I just find that it makes a good background for romance.
How graphic do you think a book should be? I'm going to lead into something that might be a little bit controversial here. Well, I'm thinking about the blood and guts side, the violent side.
I think it needs to be, for the book I've just done, it does include quite a large portion of Waterloo. And you cannot get away from the carnage that actually goes on. I think at Waterloo, at the end of the day, there were 40,000 bodies on the battlefield in one day, which is quite horrendous, yeah. Really.
Did you do quite a bit of research then?
We did a Waterloo battlefield tour a long time ago, and I have researched it since. Especially I came back to it for this one. I do think it's important for the history. I like the history to be correct when I'm writing a book.
Are your books based on real historical figures, or do real historical figures appear in your books?
Real historical figures appear, but only as minor characters. Wellington is in this book that I've done, but he appears as a minor character in the distance. I really like to create my own characters, but you need to have some real historical ones there in the background.
Right. Do you give them a personality, or is it just a kind of as you say, a minor appearance that they're just there, sat on a horse, and they? Or do they actually interact?
They don't tend to interact, but they are talked about.
Right.
This one, because they're in Brussels, my hero is a colonel, and he has to report to Wellington, and other people have to call into the headquarters, and they see Wellington going by. It's there are a lot of real accounts. It's all tied in with the real events of the day. So you have to have a certain time scale of what was happening when. The actual book we used, there were three of us writing a book each, and I got the best one, I think, because I actually do the Battle of Waterloo.
Oh,
the
right,
other two
okay.
girls, authors, are writing books that follow on from the day after Waterloo.
Oh, right,
mine
so this is
a
series of three,
it's
three volumes.
It's a trilogy. They're all standalone.
Oh, right. Oh, great.
But there are three of us. We've each written a book. They're all historical romances, but mine leads
wonderful.
Up to Waterloo and contains the battle. Theirs is mainly from the day after.
Right.
So
I'm going to throw you a bit of a curveball now, but you can dodge it if
okay.
you want. You can sort of leave it to go. You know, I was talking about the graphic side, and I
mm-hmm.
mentioned violence. So now I'm going to talk about sex. Because obviously, in many people's minds, in some people's minds, romance and sex, there's a kind of a link there.
There tends to be a link between romance and sex. You can't get away from it.
To what extent and how descriptive? I mean, you know, what's happened recently with 50 Shades of Grey,
mm-hmm.
that the boundaries have been pushed. How do you feel about that with your writing? How do you approach that?
Well, let's use the analogy of Tarantino. I don't particularly like Tarantino's films, there's too much blood in them.
It's too direct, is it?
Yes.
It's too confrontational.
But I believe that if you're an adult, you know that carnage goes on the battlefield, so it has to be there in the background. With sex in novels, it depends on the book. A lot of my books, especially in the Melinda Hammond romances, a lot of the heroines are fairly innocent. It wouldn't be right for them to... for those books to go beyond the bedroom door.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes sex can be alluded to. And in some of my other Melinda Hammonds, the dual time ones that I've written, there are sex scenes. For Harlequin, Mills and Boone, they tend to be more passionate, and they all do go beyond the bedroom door, but all very tastefully done and all in context.
But it's all directed...
And it all is... they are fairly tame these days because it's all just one man and one woman and right. their relationship. The relationship
Nothing
is
kinky.
The main thing. Nothing kinky. Yeah. No. No. Although I believe Harlequin do have certain lines yeah. that do
But
that,
it's
but
all directed
mine.
At a particular audience. When you have an audience in mind when you're writing it. Because it sounds to me like as what you're saying is you write two different types of books
some
depending
people,
on...
Well, some people... As with adventure books, some people skip the sex as they would skip the carnage in a war book. Some people don't like it there at all. But I think if it's in context and relevant, then it should be it can be in. But you write what you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is why I won't go to anything kinky.
Well, it's probably, I mean, I agree.
I
don't think it's necessarily necessary to show everything. I mean, the Greeks, for example, all their plays, any violence that occurred off stage. It did not occur on the stage itself. You would see the results of that violence or the results of that kind of interaction or what had happened when the characters came back onto the stage. But they didn't actually sort of perpetrate
That's right.
violence
you don't,
on stage
You don't
at all.
Need a blow-by-blow account.
Right.
If you excuse the expression, for the sex or the violence, in my opinion. But if sometimes it's necessary, in the Waterloo book I've finished, the hero's brother, I don't think I give him too much away because it's a long time in the distance, his brother dies in his arms. And that's one of the, it's really sad from
As
my point of view.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
it had to happen. You cannot have a battle and have everybody escape.
Well, you need
without...
the emotional impact,
yeah.
don't you? The emotional
yeah.
impact of that
you
kind
do.
Of event without sort of being maybe too descriptive or excessively
No, people can use their imaginations.
Of course. Of course.
They know what goes on and they know that war is a horrible
I'm a great believer
thing.
In suggestion. You can suggest certain things without actually having to explicitly... Describe them,
yeah.
Perhaps time for a little bit more music. We're going to listen to another selection from Melinda. This is Chopin.
Okay.
And lyrical and romantic.
It's Chopin's piano concerto. I play the piano very badly, but I do love piano music. And I only discovered Chopin about 10 years ago. I absolutely love the slow movements of his piano concertos. I find they're very reflective.
Right.
And
okay.
I like to listen. I like to have music on in the background and to listen to it while I'm writing. It cuts
okay.
out
and you listen to Chopin while you write?
And I listen to Chopin while
okay.
I write.
Okay. Well, let's listen to a bit of Chopin then. Thank you. Okay, Piano Concerto Number 1, Chopin there. Very nice piece of music. We were talking about romance, and how would you say you approach your romantic descriptions then? Would you say you said you stop outside the bedroom door and you kind of imply what's happened?
On some books, it depends. You don't need to put in sex scenes. Right. People should always write what they're comfortable with. If you're not comfortable with what you're writing, the reader won't be, and they won't enjoy it, so there's no point in doing it. But it depends on the context of the book. Some books, if you're doing a romance, and there won't be sex before marriage, others there will be, depending on the hero and the heroine and the story.
Presumably you have to adjust to the morality of the particular period of time as well.
Very much so. I do think with historicals you have to look into the mindset of the period.
What
wouldn't want to go back further than Georgian period. I've done one or two that go back to Tudor, and it does get more difficult the further back you go, because religion was much more important in their mindset and their upbringing. With the Georgians, as we were saying about Jane Austen at the beginning of the interview, people these days, readers can relate to her because the human nature hasn't changed that much in the last 200 years. But it was still a different world, and right. The society.
Your books
was different.
Tend to be set, though, in England and Europe.
They tend to be England and Europe. I'm not sure I'd feel comfortable writing too much in any further afield.
Right. How would you characterize the mindset of England and Europe in that particular period of time? I'm not just talking about romantically, but in terms of sort of politics. And do you ever get involved in the political side of things?
The politics does come into the background to a certain extent. Whether it depends on what the story is. Sometimes it is tied up with politics, but if in some of my books, if politics is tied up with spying and war, then it's in it possibly more. I have used anti-slavery in one of my Sarah Mallory's, which was called To Catch a Husband, I think it was called. But that was about a northern industrialist, and it touches on the slave trade and the abolition. And I use the politics of the day. It was there. It was all there.
Again,
obviously, they didn't have TV, but they did have meetings and posters and flyers, like post bills that people would carry around, and they would have songs in the theatres about it. So there is a lot of politics in there. I don't want to bog my readers down with it because it's background. So it has to be. Somebody said I apply history with a light brush, which I think is a nice way to phrase it. I like it there in the background.
Do you have a particular social class in which you are more interested in terms of your characters? Are they upper class, middle class?
They tend to be upper class, sometimes going to upper middle class. But I tend not to write sagas or some. There are other characters in them who are of different classes, but I tend not to write about the poorer classes. I'm writing escapism, and I really don't want to. I know possibly too much about how the poor lived, and it wasn't very nice. So
yeah.
I don't want too much of it in the escapism. It's there. There is a darker element. You can see it, and it's there for people to see. But it's like watching a modern film these days. You might know that there are beggars on the streets of London, but you wouldn't see it in Love Actually.
Yeah.
So it's.
So you want your books to be sort of have a happier aspect than
yes.
than a more.
They're escapism, and if people want to escape from the cares and the worries of the day with something that is light-hearted for a while, then that's great.
Extra, yeah.
Some people like more maybe deeper stories, but. I think there's room for it all.
How do you approach your development of relationships? I mean, is it the traditional story is boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back again? Would you say that's kind of the approach that you take, or do you try to find a twist on that, or you try and do it something a little bit differently?
It varies. Especially if you're writing a romance, the boy and girl or the man and woman have to meet up fairly soon on in the story because that's what the reader expects.
Yeah.
You then have to work at keeping them apart till the end of the book. So you have to have things getting in their way, emotional conflicts and physical conflicts getting in their way and keeping them apart. In the book that's out at the moment by Sarah Mallory, The Scarlet Gown, it's the fact that they don't trust each other. She is hired to play a role at his house, and she doesn't really know why she's playing it or what's going on, so she doesn't really trust him, although there is an attraction growing there.
Right.
And there are things going on, country house mystery going on in the background.
Where do you get your plots from? I mean, you must get that. People ask that sort of question.
They just kind of come to you. They are all around. Yes, there's plots. The one for The Scarlet Gown started because I'd always wanted to write a book about a girl who is hired and doesn't know why she's been hired to wear, to turn up in this scarlet gown. I just had this vision of her wearing it.
Right.
And why was she wearing it? What was she doing there? What was the reason for it? But it's also inspired by where I live on the moors at the Yorkshire and Lancashire border. There's some wonderful moorland walks, and walking around there, I set the country house is in that area, very much where I live, and the rocks and the hills around.
Do you ever use your own house as a kind of a?
No, my house isn't really suitable for it. I have used one at Cliviger. There's an old house which was a ruin and is being renovated now. But I used that in a book called Bought for Revenge as an empty ruin, and the owner comes back seeking revenge for what happened to his family in the house when it was burned down. So I use a lot of inspiration, but I generally change all the names and the place names so that I can move them around as I want without somebody saying, oh, no, you can't get there in 5 steps or 2 minutes, so...
Do you worry about getting it wrong, about somebody coming back to you and saying, well, that didn't happen in that, or that wasn't right, or that?
I do, to a certain extent, but I follow Bernard Cornwell's advice. I'm writing a novel. If people want history or fact, they need to read factual books.
Something else.
I like the history to be correct, if I can, as correct as I can make it in the background, so people won't pick up false history from what I'm writing. But it is only a novel.
Right,
if it gives them a taste for history and they want to learn more, then that's brilliant. That's how I got into a lot of history, was by reading historical novels.
Became interested.
Okay, Melinda, thanks very much for joining us. And we'll sign off with perhaps one last song.
Michael Ball. This is a song. I love musicals, and I like Michael Ball's voice. I think he's got a lovely voice for songs. And this is a song from the musical Mac and Mabel. It's called I Won't Send Roses. And it sums up the character of the hero, Colonel Randall, from my Waterloo book. He is a stiff upper lip Englishman through and through. And there is no way that he's going to court a woman by sending her roses or doing anything at all romantic. And he's going to get his comeuppance at Waterloo in more than one way. And this song, for me, sums it up.
Okay, let's listen to Michael Ball.
I won't send roses or hold the door. I won't remember which dress you wore. My heart is too much in control. The lack of romance in my soul will turn you gray, kid. So stay away, kid. Forget my shoulder when you're in need. Forgetting birthdays is guaranteed. And should I love you, you would be the last to know. Send roses and roses suit you. So my pace is frantic, my temper's cross with words romantic. I'm at a loss. I'd be the first one to agree that I'm preoccupied with me, and it's inbred, kid. So keep your head, kid. In me you'll find things like guts and nerve, but not the kind things that you deserve. And so while there's a fighting chance, just turn and go. I won't send roses, and roses soon.